All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a special segment that airs every week at 5:30 on Tuesdays. It's called Totality of Circumstances. I'm Sam Bowman.
Jasmine Moneymaker.
And happy birthday, Jasmine, by the way. We'll get that
great.
Out of the
Thanks.
Way.
Thanks. Call me out.
Headline number one. So this week we're going to talk about primarily about the PPB's ongoing rollout of its body cam proposal. This is the second time in my living memory that they've tried to do this. They had a attempt going from 2014 to 15 that didn't go so hot, but we'll get into that in a little bit, and there'll be more on the show, but we wanted to try to take a look at some news stories that have been happening over the past week that we have not had time to expand on this show, but we wanted to make sure that everyone knew about them.
Well, I mean, it's been a huge week.
Huge.
Starting with the day after last Tuesday, Portland City Council voted us all out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which was a huge win for activists in the city who have been trying for years to make the community feel safer for people. I mean, the bulk of the testimony that went on for hours, there were some like 36 people who testified, and I watched all of it, and by my count, there were only two people who voted to remain in the Joint Terrorism, or not voted, but who recommended that Portland remain in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Worth mentioning, they were both white males. But it was just, it was hours of testimony of people talking about their real lived experience with being victimized by the FBI. And it's hard for me to... It's hard for me to see how Mayor Wheeler and Commissioner Fish like followed that up with the idea that somehow we could, you know, if we stayed in the Joint Terrorism Task Force, we could play nice with the FBI. Like it's better to be with them than against them. But in the end, the decision was made to leave, and that is that would have been the biggest news of last week if not for the joint reporting. Well, I don't know if it was actually joint reporting, but the reports that came out of Willamette Week and the Portland Mercury by Katie Shepard and Alex Zielinski about the text messages, the Jeffrey Nia text messages.
Yeah. So in case you missed it, which if you're listening to this show that airs after the KBO News, you probably did not miss it. Jeff Nia was the lieutenant in charge of the rapid response team, which is the, you know, the vests and armor that you see at the big protest events that have been happening in Portland over the past 2 years, and before that, the riot cops, you know, he was found to be texting in a very friendly manner with Joey Gibson, the leader of Patriot Prayer, who has brought the brawlers to the city pretty much for the last 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, the texts are pretty sticky his role is, Jeffrey Nia's role is to communicate with protest leaders and protest participants. I mean, we've heard his name come up again and again at city council sessions and in other reporting over the years. But, I mean, I think a lot of people felt like this just really crossed the line, especially because he seemed to be protecting Tiny, who is a street brawler, essentially. And
it was a Tusitala Toese.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we should point out, they seem to cross the line for us and for most people who seem to be paying attention to this story, but it points to general practices by police officers who are getting ready to respond to protests like this. I mean, just today, the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association announced that it was filing a formal complaint against the city for having Nia removed from his duty as lieutenant of the rapid response team. And that's, you know, because they feel that the way the city has been talking about him in the wake of this is derogatory and detrimental to his career, And I mean, the unspoken part of that is that this is how police communicate with
right-wing... well, this is how police communicate with everybody, you know? And that's, I mean, that's the thing is, like, there's... we have an interview coming up later on the show with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. And at the end of the interview, he makes a comment, you know, about the idea of community policing and what that means to the police as opposed to the people in the community. And, you know, essentially the idea is that this is how the police operate. They operate, they form relationships with people, not in an effort to make them safer necessarily, although that is a reason that they put forward and that might sometimes be the case. But the ultimate consequence of the, you know, that sort of power imbalance is that what they're really doing is essentially surveilling people, even when what they're doing is they're having these text message conversations, they're forming these relationships with people. The ultimate goal is not, I shouldn't say the ultimate goal is not, the ultimate goal is to police them more effectively. And the disconnect between that and what the community expects of the police is pretty interesting.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot I was on the radio for a minute. I was just nodding along there. So what else happened this week? You were saying
Katie Sheppard had like a double whammy. So she did Jeffrey Nia text, and then she got something that has kind of, like, I've seen it in a few places, but I feel like it should really be a much bigger story. I mean, she basically found out that the Multnomah County prosecutors, the DA's office, have been, I don't know, falsifying might be a strong word, but I think that's essentially what happened, been happening, falsifying their grand jury results. So basically what happens is if the prosecutors take a case to the grand jury and the grand jury declines to issue an indictment, it's called a no bill. And when that happens, the prosecutor's office is supposed to formally log that no bill in the system, because then they need a court order to reinitiate another grand jury. And the prosecutor's office just basically wasn't doing that. They were logging it as no decision instead. So they were essentially violating the constitutional rights of Portlanders for decades. And that's kind of a big story.
Yeah. Right? And even in Willamette Week, it was, you know, 4 or 5 paragraphs. And I'm curious to see what comes out of this. And on that note, we probably should move on. And for the sake of this show.
Sorry, everybody.
No, that's there's a lot to chew on there. And hopefully there's more details for next week, I guess.
Yeah.
What was it? Saturday morning, I went to the first town hall that the police bureau held for its new proposed body cam program, body-worn cameras, as they call them. So there's 3 of them scheduled, and this is, aside from the online form, this is how the bureau is getting feedback from people from in the community. And they are, you know, they said multiple times, like, we don't know how this is going to be, for example, with body cameras in schools, body cameras in hospitals, when they're going to be turned off. We don't know. The law doesn't tell us what we need to do in certain situations, and that's why we're asking you, the people in this room. And as it turned out, there were about 23 people in there, and I would say that myself and 2 others were media, at least OPB and the East Portland News were there. I apologize to the East Portland News if I'm getting that wrong, but they have a pretty solid website. They do like 4,000 stories over the last 10 years or something, all about East Portland. There were about 10 bureau employees there and 2 facilitators, which leaves about, I think, 8 or 9...
members of the general public?
Actual members of the general public.
That's not a bad turnout for a PPB event, to be honest.
It's not. It's less than 50%, but it's... So to give you an idea of what sort of community feedback was being gotten from this, so I sat at... The first table I sat at was me, the OPB reporter, the bureau facilitator, a police officer named Natasha Hounsberger, and then two community members, so two out of the six people at the table. And this is, the two community members were members of the Lentz Neighborhood Livability Organization, and this should give you a little bit of an idea about what sort of feedback the Bureau is getting. This is starts with Officer Hansberger asking them what to do in the event of, you know, recording Miranda rights.
If an officer is placing someone under arrest and recording the advisement of Miranda rights, do you think that should be recorded for both officers?
I would
and
record
the
it.
Oh yeah.
I would record it because they're going to get down there and they're going to say that never was. I never heard that. I would record it for your sake.
Okay.
Yeah, as a policy matter, I think it would be very good for the police to record that.
I mean, I don't know what you deal with on a daily basis, but just walking down our street.
We know what we encounter. Which brings up another point, which I think would be good. It would be good for the public, I guess, because there seems to be, there are many people that do not trust the police, and I really think that so much of what the police do is not police work, but mental health, evaluation, or just coming into contact with someone who's in a mental health crisis. I really think those incidents need to be recorded because they can turn bad so quickly that there isn't time to activate a camera when the guy pulls out a knife or
hatchet.
So this sounds like if you're saying, like, you know, you're responding on an ECIT call that you would be recording, or if you're responding where there's a suspected component of mental health.
Right.
Okay.
So it sounds like that was a big part of the concern there, was specifically like how officers will respond to mental health calls and what the body cams will do in that case. And was there any resolution on that, or was there any?
Well, there was very little resolution from this event in general. And to be fair, that's not what they were looking for. They just wanted feedback on certain things. But there was a fair amount of mention of mental health situations. In fact, kind of playing off of that, the Ella Fritz shooting back in April of last year, the one that happened at the City Team Ministries shelter on Southeast Grand, that came up briefly in the context of cell phone footage of the event, which doesn't really answer your question about mental health, because that didn't quite address that. But, you know, just the way that I should say, in general, the comments that they seem to have received and taken to heart really are the ones that support officers having the footage for their own protection.
Right.
And there was some lip service paid to, you know, the community having access to some, but mostly it was about the ins and outs of an officer's interaction with body cams.
I mean, where would you say that was coming from? Because, I mean, you mentioned that this isn't the first time that the Portland Police Bureau has been down this road, and there was a set of, you know, sort of draft directives that was released in 2015 when this project happened before. And sort of like the, out of privacy considerations, you know, there's an Oregon law in place that lays out quite a few things about specific to body cams, but one of the gray areas in that law is the privacy considerations, especially related to mental health. So, like, where would you say that those concerns were coming from? Is that from the public, or is that from the PPB in terms of officers having access to the footage?
Well, in this town hall, I'd say it was both. I mean, and one thing I would say is it definitely feels like a restart from zero compared to the 2014-15 effort, because that largely petered out after the negotiations with the police union over this issue of officers being allowed to view footage from the cameras before writing their report on the incident that is depicted on the cameras.
Right.
And this time around, I mean, so after every... So what happens is we sit at tables in small groups at these things, and there's a specific topic for each table. And the table I was at, the first table that you just heard some audio from, after that, they went around to every table, like, what'd you learn? And one of the tables, the next one that I went to, what they said in this, after the first table, sorry, what they said was, one thing we're hearing is, like, there's not a lot of problems with officers being allowed to view footage, in so many words.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need to really wait for... I don't really need to explain that myself because I have a recording. The next table that I sat at was me, two police officers, one of them was a sergeant, a Bureau civilian employee, and one of the facilitators. So there were no just flat-out community members at this table at all, which was awkward for me because I am a volunteer, but also a reporter. I also work in like a social services setting, so I have my own questions about, you know, where officers are allowed to turn their cameras on and stuff. But anyway, I asked the sergeant, and his name is Mark Friedman. He's with the Gun Violence Reduction Task Force, and there was also Officer Carlos Ibarra, who's a school resource officer there. I asked them about why cops should be allowed to view footage before the report, and this was Friedman's answer to that.
It's kind of I'm simplifying it a little bit, but I guess generally speaking, you know, the video is the video, right?
Yeah.
The officer still has to justify and articulate their whatever actions they may or may not have taken, given the circumstances. I don't think that for the office, a lot of officers, their perspective is, if I'm permitted to view the video and I can articulate all of that in my report, that benefits everybody. That's not a space in the word. My intent is not evil, because I didn't...
There's no malintent.
Right, I was permitted to view the video and document it accurately the first time around.
So that, I mean, that comment about, you know, it not being something surreptitious, I think is the word he was looking for, in them reviewing the footage, it really kind of misses the point that what we're looking for in officer reporting is an accurate representation of their actual thoughts at the time. And there are significant legal reasons why that's what we want to hear. And so I understand that they wouldn't necessarily think there was any malintent, but that's still, you know, kind of a challenge when it comes to whether or not, like, what we're hearing is their actual recollection or something supported by video evidence. But anyway, I mean, it'll be interesting to hear at the next meeting, which is, I think, coming up on, is it Friday? Friday the 22nd from 2:30 to 4:30 at the Matt Dishman Community Center.
Exactly. That's in Northeast Portland, I believe, yeah.
If anybody wants to show up for that and have an opportunity to get more feedback and...
Yeah, we'll be there. Say hi.
Yeah, come say hi to us. All right, so now for the last story of tonight, we are going to enter into the realm of the acronyms that we all know and loathe. And so 2 weeks ago, we reported on the presentation of a draft report at the PSEP meeting. And PSEP is, of course, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing.
So PICSEP. I guess it's an accurate name.
And this report is a part of the requirements of the U.S. DOJ settlement agreement, which we've talked about many times and are going to try to avoid explaining anew each time we mention it, but it's going to come up again and again. So the deadline for public comment on this most recent draft report was the 15th, and the final report is due to be released on the 28th. As always, Portland Cop Watch composed a detailed and thorough analysis of the report, and I talked to Dan Handelman by phone earlier today about the group's main takeaways. All right, so this report covered sections 8 and 9 of the settlement agreement dealing with officer accountability and community engagement and the creation of the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. From your comments, some of the biggest takeaways for you had to deal with their interpretation of traffic stop data. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so in the community engagement section, originally the board that the PCCET replaced was supposed to help design what kind of data was going to be collected around traffic stops, but that got jettisoned when they revised the settlement agreement to create the PCCET. Right now, the Bureau just has to share these data with the new board, but they haven't done so yet. So anyway, what we found is that rather than dive into the numbers themselves or ask serious questions about it, the compliance officer kind of praised the police bureau for making this what they're calling a very thorough, sophisticated, and transparent analysis, but which really was what we call statistical gymnastics, trying to deny the fact that Portland police racially profile.
There are significant disparities in the number of African-American Portlanders who are stopped compared to their representation in the census, but they explain that that doesn't indicate biased policing because of their crime victimization benchmark. Can you explain that?
Well, I can't explain it from a logical point of view, but their thought is that even though Portland is 6% black and 13% of people that are pulled over are African-American in the city, that we shouldn't be concerned because the crash data show that 9% of adult drivers who have, or people of driving age who have accidents are African-American. But then the stop rate should be 9% and not 13%, which is what it is. So they're already not making sense there. And then they jump to looking at the gang enforcement team, which is buried in the back of the Bureau's analysis that the COCL is reporting on. And the gang enforcement team has a stop rate of 61% of African Americans in a city that's 6% black. And instead of being alarmed by this or worrying about it, the Bureau says, oh, well, but 71% of victims of gang crime are black, therefore we're actually understopping that population. And the COCL doesn't take them to task for doing this or question it or do his own analysis. He just says, wow, this is great, you know, look at all these number crunches that they did.
It just seems to me that regardless of whether or not those are effective benchmarks, what the data show is still that black people are being over-policed in Portland.
Correct. And they even, when you get down to it, you know, a lot of times, and this argument wasn't really made in either report, but a lot of times when we accuse them of bias-based policing, they say, well, when we're driving along at night, we can't really see what color the driver is, so, you know, you can't say that's racially biased. But then when you look at who's getting searched, African-Americans are searched at above the rate of white people, and they're found not to have contraband at any higher rate than anybody else. In fact, I don't remember if I did crunch numbers on this particular report, but generally speaking, we find that only about 80% as much contraband is found on African Americans because they're being over-searched, so therefore the quote-unquote hit rate, what they call when they find contraband, is lower. So that's an example of over-policing. The gang enforcement team, the COCL notes, searches African Americans. Well, they use what they call consent searches, which is like, do you mind if I search you? Which when there's a police officer with a gun and a badge and pepper spray and a taser staring at you, a lot of people aren't going to refuse that, even though it's their right to, if they don't have probable cause. And they overuse those, and then they find less contraband as a result. Just the gang enforcement team, but I think that's generally true for other traffic stops as well.
What you're sort of describing is just an overall lack of analysis being done by the COCL. They're just taking the data from the PPB, looking at it without auditing the data or trying to collect their own data. And for a group that's supposed to be independent, it really just sort of seems like they're not doing the job that the community expects them to do. And it seems like that's a consistent theme in their reports.
And our feedback on the reports. And, you know, we constantly make little digs at the COCL for not being from Portland, but, you know, it sounds kind of minor, but it's actually really important. I think that if there was a compliance officer that lived here, they'd have a better perspective on all this means. And, you know, for example, the the number of pedestrian stops has plummeted by almost 90%, and they don't question why that might be. And they say, oh, it's probably part, well, they say they think it's because of the concerns nationwide about, you know, people being over-policed in the wake of Ferguson. But I think that it's more that police in Portland aren't reporting what you and I would consider to be a stop anymore. And so that's why the numbers are down. They're actually still stopping people. I mean, we hear people about people being harassed and even witness it from, you know, pretty regularly. But they have the number of pedestrian stops is only about 25 people per quarter, which is, oh no, it's per month, 25 people per month. You know, so you're saying that there's 800 police officers out on patrol in a city of 600,000 people plus, and they only stop 25 people a month? I don't believe that at all.
And we don't have any evidence that the COCL has been looking into that, that they asked that question or pursued an answer.
That is true. I really like to see somebody dig in and find out what's going on. There was a captain named Larry Graham, who we had a lot of disagreements with. He's the person who pulled the permit on May Day 2017 when all hell broke loose because of the police riot. But he was on a board that was called the Community Police Relations Committee, and he was saying that in addition to stops, we should also be collecting data on mere conversations, which is the kind of discussions that we were talking about before. And then that board fell apart, and then there was nobody left in the Bureau saying, well, we should really find a way to track those. But that's a very important thing for the community to be asking for, that the police should track mere conversations, and then we can see whether they're over-policing certain segments of the community.
As far as the Portland Committee on Community-Engaged Policing goes, the PCEP, they got high marks from the Rosenbaum group in this report. But as you point out, it's really kind of too early to tell exactly what's going to happen with them. All right, so that, unfortunately, we're not going to have time to air the rest of that interview right now. We will put it up online for y'all to listen to. But that was Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch talking about the group's recent feedback of the COCL report. So we're going to dive right in the last couple minutes to the calendar updates. Tomorrow, the CRC has a work group in room 110 at City Hall from 5:30 to 6:30. That is on their crowd control policies. And then the PPB is hosting a listening session for the Jeffrey Nia Patriot Prayer Text on Thursday from 6 to 8 at the Marantha Church on 12th and Skidmore. And then, as we already mentioned, the next PPB Body Cam Forum is February 22nd from 2:30 to 4:30 at Matt Dishman Community Center. And finally, the PCEP, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, is holding their monthly meeting at 5:30 on Tuesday. That's next Tuesday at Tabor Space.
And what was I going to say? Oh, next week, tune in at 5:30 to Totality of Circumstances. We're going to have the Portland State University Student Union, SUSU, on the show to talk about issues that they're engaged with. Good night, Jasmine.
Good night, Sam.
And good night, Liam. Thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Liam.